Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Plastic Capitalism, Banks, Credit Cards, and the End of Financial Control by Sean H. Venata. Narrated by Stephen R. Thorne. Preface. Buying Time. Before I knew I would write a book, this project began as an attempt to answer some questions about myself. When I was an undergraduate, I racked up about $3,000 in credit card debt in rather short order. I then struggled for years to bring the balance down. Why, I wanted to know, did I think accumulating the debt was a good idea? How did I convince myself, a college student without a stable income, that I would borrow to buy responsibly? I started a graduate program in U.S. history still pondering these questions. In my first attempt to formulate a research topic, I projected them onto the nation's recent past. Why had so many Americans taken on so much high-interest debt in the 1980s, the 1990s, and after? What changes in the nation's society and culture convinced them to do so? To frame my thinking, I examined national statistics, where I saw my experience reflected in the parabolic rise of credit card borrowing, indebtedness that peaked in May 2008 at more than $1 trillion. I read books like Robert Manning's Credit Card Nation, which offered sociological explanations for the nation's so-called credit addiction. I talked to a marketing professor who had worked on American Express's class-coded branding, green, gold, platinum, black. Yet I couldn't see a viable research design or set of sources that would shine new light on why consumers borrowed so much, so often. Individual borrowing choices were just that, I reasoned. Individual, idiosyncratic. Borrowing is also personal and private. Even if people had reflected on their choices, there could hardly be enough evidence to make generalizable claims about American society. My project needed a new direction. To find one, I transitioned from why to how. How did it become possible for American consumers to take on so much unsecured debt? That question led me to focus not so much on society and culture, but on public policy and business strategy. The story I uncovered begins in the 1930s with Franklin D. Roosevelt's New Deal. Amid the ravages of the Great Depression, the Roosevelt administration sought to revive the economy by encouraging household borrowing. To do so, the New Dealers created both federal welfare programs that made many American families creditworthy and federal lending programs that made low-cost credit widely available for privileged households. Consumer credit became a tool for American welfare policy, one managed by the federal government and, I discovered, the states. Through a mix of federal and state regulation, the New Dealers channeled credit toward social priorities and granted consumers oversight over state-level credit markets. The New Deal created, in effect, a place-based social contract for finance. Throughout the post-World War II decades, state laws restrained finance and financial profits. Bankers, unsurprisingly, chafed under these restrictive rules. They seized credit cards as one way to innovate around them. Cards became the era's fintech, novel financial technology, space-age plastic. In the 1950s and 1960s, bankers used cards to offer high-interest loans outside the bounds of existing regulations. The New Deal financial structure, though, proved resilient. Consumer and labor groups organized for and secured state-level limits on credit card interest rates. State price caps shifted the risk of long-term interest fluctuations onto card issuers, discouraging bankers and other lenders from putting consumers into long-term credit card debt. In the early 1980s, however, opportunistic bankers found another way to undermine state credit rules. They relocated their card businesses to states like South Dakota and Delaware, with the most favorable regulations, curtailing the ability of all states to regulate the price of credit. Banks then opened the spigots. Plastic capitalism thus recovers state regulation as a foundational component of the New Deal's safe and stable financial system, and uncovers a missing hinge on which the U.S. turned toward risky, expensive finance in the decades after 1980. I show how, for a time, state-level financial regulation restrained consumer indebtedness. I have tried to do so, however, without being naive or nostalgic. It's not just that white supremacists defended slavery and later Jim Crow segregation under the tarnished banner of states' rights. State governments were and are centers of political power, where interest groups compete to imprint their goals onto public policy. In this book, I recount how privileged consumers used state interest rate caps to extend a bargain made during the New Deal that guaranteed low-cost credit to white, male breadwinner-led families. The most sophisticated did so knowing that new rate caps would exclude poor and minority households from credit access, forcing them toward high-cost fringe finance. The eventual hamstringing of state regulation changed the terms of financial inequality, but not its essential substance. Instead of exclusion, after the 1980s, borrowers assigned lower credit scores, often poor and minority consumers, experienced what Kianga Yamata Taylor has called predatory inclusion. They paid higher prices for credit, faced a raft of charges and service fees, and risked debt collection and bankruptcy. Meanwhile, card firms offered middle-income and elite consumers less expensive credit and a buffet of perks and rewards. Freed of regulatory restraints, credit cards became engines of upward redistribution. They also became immensely lucrative for banks and for the networks, Visa and MasterCard, that control the private payment systems in our 21st century economy. I began this project interested in consumer indebtedness and economic precarity. But through researching and writing, the book also became a story about financial industry growth and banking concentration. The card I received in the mid-2000s was issued by Maryland Bank, N.A., MBNA. I didn't know it at the time, but Baltimore's Maryland National Bank chartered MBNA as a Delaware subsidiary in 1982, after the bank failed to convince Maryland's legislature to allow annual fees on credit card accounts. Over time, MBNA became one of the nation's largest credit card issuers, in part by partnering with colleges and universities to offer cards to undergraduates. My card came on the letterhead of the University of Georgia Alumni Association. It had a picture of the school's mascot, UGA VI, on the front. In 2006, Bank of America acquired MBNA. With more than 5,700 branches in 30 states, Bank of America was big and growing bigger. The MBNA deal vaulted Bank of America over J.P. Morgan Chase and Citigroup to make it the nation's largest bank card issuer, with 20% of the highly concentrated credit card market. These three banks, along with American Express and Capital One, issued 3/4 of the nation's credit cards. The scale of national financial concentration, while common in other developed democracies, was new in the United States. In the 1930s, Congress designed the New Deal banking regulations to preserve a political economy of small finance. Interstate branching rules prohibited banks from building offices across state lines. Product line restrictions prevented bankers from engaging in other financial businesses, like insurance. Together with state price ceilings, these rules kept most banks small, reinforcing the place-based social contract. Banking concentration within discrete geographic markets existed, but never on a national scale. Several forces converged to erode the New Deal's barriers to concentration. Beginning in 1979, Federal Reserve Chairman Paul Volcker waged all-out war against inflation by unleashing unprecedentedly high interest rates. The tight money policy, coupled with a bipartisan movement aimed at rolling back New Deal-era rules, pressured Congress to initiate moderate price and product line deregulation in the early 1980s. Nevertheless, lawmakers maintained the system's core reliance on state boundaries to restrain national financial consolidation. The financial turbulence caused by the Fed's policy, though, gave further momentum to deregulatory ideology and ultimately greater banking concentration. As bank failures increased, federal officials encouraged strong banks to rescue weak rivals through interstate acquisitions. State legislatures, meanwhile, enacted laws that encouraged regional bank mergers ahead of direct competition from colossal New York and California banks. In 1993, Congress authorized fully interstate branching, unleashing a wave of consolidation. Then, in 1999, the New Deal's industry silos fell too, enabling concentration to spread across the financial services industry. The era of domestic megabanks, forestalled since the 1930s, had arrived. Credit cards prefigured the larger process of financial consolidation, fronting bank strategies to create regional and then national consumer businesses within the still vibrant New Deal order. This outcome was unintended and ironic. Bankers developed card plans in the 1950s to help small retailers compete with expanding department stores. Department stores already offered card-based credit. Bankers merely emulated this service. In doing so, bankers exerted greater control over local credit markets by shifting credit relationships, which merchants and consumers maintained outside of banks, into bank offices. Still, bank card plans remained small and local. Only with time and experience did bankers settle on transaction volume as a critical component of card plan profitability. As the numbers of transactions increased, they reasoned, costs per transaction would go down. Geographic expansion would generate more volume and enable banks to compete with travel and entertainment cards, issued by firms like Diners Club and American Express, that already enjoyed nationwide reach. In the late 1960s, bankers connected their local plans into regional and later nationwide networks, enabling consumers to use bank cards from coast to coast. The geographic expansion of bank card plans advanced in tension with the social ties that held financial markets together. Bankers continued to root their card plans in local relationships. They recruited consumers and merchants within reach of their branch offices. Bank card networks remained fragmented and localized, built and maintained as a collective project by banks that were confined within narrowly constructed geographic markets. Only in the mid-1970s did aggressive banks, led by New York's Citibank, arrogate the networks that the industry had built collectively to solicit cardholders on a national scale. Citi's timing, on the eve of the Volcker shock, proved first ill-chosen, then opportune. When the surging cost of money threatened to wreck their card businesses on the shoals of interest rate risk, large card issuers relocated to job-hungry states without price regulations. No longer burdened by interest rate restrictions, Citi and its peers resumed nationwide solicitations, claiming national market share at the expense of smaller and less sophisticated rivals. In their quest for scale, bankers initiated what I call Gresham's Law of Plastic, through which high-cost, high-risk credit crowded out lower-cost, less risky alternatives. Here, plastic capitalism's themes of concentration and consumer indebtedness merge. Even as market interest rates fell in the mid-1980s, the largest banks maintained heavy card promotions and high prices. Bankers justified high rates in part because they lent to riskier borrowers. High prices compensated bankers for the higher likelihood of credit losses. Predatory inclusion contained a circular, self-reinforcing logic. Expensive credit compensated lenders for extending credit to riskier borrowers. Expensive credit made consumer default more likely, justifying high prices. Over time, improved information technology enabled banks to discriminate more effectively among low and high-risk borrowers. Financial fine-tuning encouraged still more lending. As credit card debt climbed ever higher, so did consumer bankruptcies, which increased from 288,000 in 1980 to 1.5 million in 2004. This point merits emphasis. High bankruptcy rates were an expected outcome of lending large, unsecured sums to high-risk borrowers. Yet high bankruptcy rates also undermined the consumer lending markets that fueled the nation's economic engine. Mass consumer credit, emergent in the 1920s, was given robust government support during the New Deal. Even with the scaling back of the New Deal's financial regulations, the new policy regime required an active government role in structuring and policing credit markets. In the same way that policymakers had created rules to protect the pre-1980 system of low-cost consumer finance, for example, by devoting public resources to combating credit card fraud, so too did policymakers align to protect the new system of expensive and risky lending. In the 1990s and early 2000s, banks and other lenders lobbied for stronger personal bankruptcy rules to enforce credit card contracts. In 2005, Congress enacted the Bankruptcy Abuse and Consumer Protection Act, which made it harder for consumers to discharge debts through bankruptcy. The enhanced provisions of the act, in turn, may have partially motivated Bank of America's takeover of MBNA. Following the acquisition, the New York Times reported, Bank of America elected to follow the MBNA methods it had long admired, from its partnership marketing to its aggressive debt collection techniques and reliance on high fees. With concentration, the most aggressive card issuer practices became the only card issuer practices. Bad plastic money drove out the good. Together, consumer indebtedness and banking concentration point like a beacon toward the financial crisis of 2008, a drama in which Bank of America, Citigroup, and other protagonists of this book played leading parts. The crisis seemed to affirm economist Hyman Minsky's central insight that the tendency to transform doing well into a speculative investment boom is the basic instability in a capitalist economy. In the United States, much of the speculative investment flowed into consumer credit markets, most obviously housing, but credit card lending as well. The nation's long-standing reliance on consumer borrowing to drive economic growth remained, but with none of the restraint imposed by the New Deal regulatory order. As the financial system came crashing down, federal officials rescued the concentrated, systemically important firms. Citigroup, the world's second-largest bank, and by September 2008, world's largest credit card lender, was the quintessence of too big to fail. Citi's role in national and global payment systems was one of the many reasons government officials gave for repeatedly bailing out the bank. You would go out in a cab, swipe your card, and it wouldn't go through, Citigroup chairman Richard Persons explained in March 2011, likewise framing the case for rescue around Citi's dominant position in consumer payments. You wouldn't be able to buy a loaf of bread or clear a check. It would be like Egypt. People would be out in the streets. Presumably, Persons meant this as hyperbole. 6 months later, people would be out in the streets, occupying Zuccotti Park in Lower Manhattan to protest the government rescue of banks, but not of households, and thus the perpetuation of the political economy of big finance and unremitting debt. Reflecting on the affluent society the New Deal created, Harvard economist John Kenneth Galbraith asked in 1958, "Can the bill collector be the central figure in the good society?" After the 2008 crisis, it seemed like the time had come to renew Galbraith's question with purpose. Credit card debt peaked at $1 trillion in May 2008, but declined to $832 billion by May 2011. I anticipated a turning point, a recalibration. The Great Depression of the 1930s destroyed much of capitalism and threatened to destroy all of it. In its wake, a new social compromise emerged, which, in the United States, included an invigorated welfare state and the rigorous control of finance. The 2008 financial crisis threatened similarly epical destruction. Policymakers, schooled in the lessons of the 1930s, forestalled a similarly catastrophic collapse. We should not lament the rescue, but no new social compromise emerged. No new political economy took command. Instead, the nation's political leaders sought to preserve the existing system, continuing to rely on household borrowing to spur the economy forward. Piecemeal reforms provided some new consumer protections without fundamentally altering the status quo. The Dodd-Frank Act, which created the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, is one example. The Credit Card Accountability Responsibility and Disclosure, CARD Act, enacted in 2009, is another. Momentum for card reform had been building before the crisis. The CARD Act restricted a number of abusive pricing and billing practices while protecting young consumers, 18 to 21-year-olds, like me, by making it more difficult for them to get credit cards. Yet these reforms came without addressing the underlying reasons young consumers borrowed in the first place, likely pushing cash-strapped undergraduates toward other forms of debt. I finally paid off my card balance with a federal student loan. In recent years, credit card borrowing has resumed its galloping growth, and student loan debt has grown even faster. This is a book of history, and I will not venture either policies or predictions. It is also a book concerned, at its core, with the fraught relationship between capitalism and democracy. The Great Depression of the 1930s nearly ended both experiments. The New Deal, in different ways, rescued both, in part by making capitalism subject to a greater measure of democratic participation and oversight. In finance, this order was twofold. First, through the institutions of federalism, organized consumers enforced a place-based social contract. That contract proved fundamentally inadequate. It excluded low-income and minority groups from the bargaining table and from mainstream credit markets. Nevertheless, the New Deal regulatory order enabled consumers to shape vigorous credit regulations to match their expectations for economic fairness in America's rapidly changing consumer society. Second, the continued maintenance of the political economy of small finance ensured that most banks remained small. Fear of concentrated finance was elemental to the American democratic tradition. In the post-war era, policymakers worried that large, concentrated financial firms would favor large corporate borrowers over the small proprietors who embodied the ideal of American free enterprise. In league with small bankers, congressional policymakers maintained a fragmented financial system, which limited bank profits and channeled bank lending toward public purposes. This book is about the end of both restraints. Bankers adopted cards to escape the regulatory checks on financial profits. They used cards to escape democratic oversight. The New Deal emerged from the failure of capitalism to reconcile itself to democracy, and the failure of financial capitalism in particular to provide the stability required by democratic society. The New Deal restrained private finance and bent its powers toward public purposes. Other developed economies followed even more restrictive paths. Yet, through its use of private finance, the New Deal opened the door for financiers to grasp the mantle of public legitimacy, to deliver the prosperity promised by the New Deal while disavowing democratic control. Credit cards, as I demonstrate in this book, were central to a long contest between those who sought prosperity through regulation and those who sought prosperity without it. Still, the rise of finance after 1980 was not the result of a grand design. It was incremental, opportunistic, and often clumsy. It operated through a fragmented political system, which offered stakeholders a variety of tools for shaping and reshaping market rules. It rested on a legal system that often struggled to apply inherited legal categories to the strategic deployment of new financial technologies. Although this book ends in the 1980s with bankers' manipulation of the political structure to shield themselves from democratic control, it forcefully demonstrates the long and successful efforts of consumers and other stakeholders to shape card markets through democratic institutions. Introduction. In April 2006, Citigroup CEO Charles Chuck Prince III made a special visit to Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Formed by the 1998 Union of Travelers Insurance and New York's Citibank, Citigroup was the world's largest financial services company. The merger, which also included Travelers Investment Bank subsidiary Solomon Smith Barney, blasted through regulatory silos that had divided commercial and investment banking since the New Deal's 1933 Glass-Steagall Act. Backed into a corner, Congress finally dismantled these barriers the following year.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?